Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Absence does make the heart grow fonder. So fond that sometimes it can cast a shadow over everything else, as it did for David Vesey. Griffin Dunn of the Amazon series I Love Dick reads David's essay, Before the Web, Hearts Grew Silent.
Sometimes when I'm watching old movies, I can't help dwelling on the crucial plot devices that have been lost to, well, devices. The missed phone call, which today rings in our pockets. The wrong turn down a dark road, easily avoided with GPS. The long-lost love, who now lives forever in our Twitter feed. Consider the ending of Dr. Zhivago, when a chance sighting of Lara on a city street leads Yuri's heart to rupture as she disappears before he can reach her. Had the internet been around during the Bolshevik Revolution, Yuri and Lara would never have lost each other. They would have been Facebook comrades, boring each other to death with snapshots of food, borscht, and ironic observations of proletariat struggle. Consider the plot twist in our own lives, moments that hinged on uncertainty, when communication was tenuous and all information was not laid out before us. Modern technology has made our world smaller and our lives easier, but perhaps it also has diminished life's mysteries, and with them, some sense of romance. In the summer of 1991, without social networks to tether us, I felt such heart-bursting longing for a woman I loved that I traveled across two countries and an ocean to make sure she would not wander out of my life. It was only in her absence, in a total vacuum away from her, that I was able to appreciate the depth of love I felt. We met in March while I was still in college. She had recently graduated and was knocking around Peoria, Illinois, her hometown, figuring out her next step. After two chance meetings, we began going out. Before long, we were rarely apart. This was the old-fashioned way of falling in love. All our attentions were on each other. We spent less time with our friends, who could not track the electronic footprints of our relationship. We didn't have cell phones buzzing every 5 minutes, distracting us with non-essential chatter. Neither of us was tapping away, eyes downward, communicating with other people during meals. The outside world fell away, and it became just us slowly unlocking each other's secrets, dreams, and opinions, which in those days were not posted on walls for anybody to casually scroll through. We felt we were the only two people in the world. But our time together was coming to an end. Before we met, I had planned a summer backpacking adventure across Europe, and Joelle had been talking about a move to Chicago. I told her I would write while I was away, and I gave her the address of a friend in Wales, where I would be with my parents at the midpoint of my trip. It would be my only fixed location for the next 8 weeks. Admittedly, no promises were made, but part of me felt as if our relationship would just resume when I came back. Disappearing into Europe alone for 2 months was not all that unusual. Back then, a 21-year-old could trek across Europe for 2 months with no reasonable expectation of anything more than a postcard, much less continual status updates. The whole point was to get lost. After landing in Frankfurt, I visited the Roman ruins in Trier, spent the summer solstice in Strasbourg, and saw a rock concert in a soccer stadium packed with 50,000 Germanic-looking bikers in Basel. In Budapest, my ancestral home, I heard church choirs and stood before masterworks of art. It was amazing and beautiful and inspiring, and I was miserable. All I could think about was Joelle. Sitting alone on a bench outside St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna, eating street schnitzel, I wished I were back at Lum's in Peoria, sitting across from her. As I stared at the emerald green Rhine in Switzerland, I found myself longing for the murky Illinois River. I wrote her letters as if I could will her into my trip, long, heartfelt missives. The idea of her reading my letters, of experiencing what I was experiencing, was what kept me going. The trip had become meaningless with her not a part of it. By the time I reached London to rendezvous with my parents, I was inconsolable. The distance between us had become unfathomable, and my spirit sank to a depth I had never known. I tried to act in a manner befitting a 21-year-old man who was now a world traveler. I sobbed and pouted and slunk around London for 3 days. Finally, my father insisted, that I just call her. From our hotel room in London, I called Peoria, except that Joelle wasn't in Peoria. Her mother told me that she had packed up and moved to Chicago. My letters, she said, were sitting there on the table, unopened. I called Chicago next, but was unable to reach her. There was no answer. No machine, no voicemail, no caller ID to show the missed call, just a landline ringing in an empty apartment. There was no way of knowing where she was or when she would be back. I became gripped by jealousy, panicked by the idea of her moving on, settling into a new life, meeting new people. Here I was in Europe, weeping in front of relics for all the wrong reasons, and she was gallivanting around Chicago meeting people? It seemed ludicrous to admit that I somehow thought she might hang around Peoria waiting for me. But that was, it occurred to me, exactly what I expected. My parents and I drove to Wales the next day, and when there was no letter from Joelle waiting, I broke down into a blubbering mess. My body was in Wales, surrounded by craggy green hills and bleeding sheep, but my heart was in Chicago. My parents put me on a train back to London the next morning. I was looking to catch the next flight home. At Heathrow, however, I was told that the round-trip airline ticket my parents had bought me could be used only out of Paris. So it was off to Dover, where I caught a late-night ferry across the Channel. The boat was filled with fellow students, and as we staggered off in Calais and rode the night train to Paris, I regaled them with my tale of woe. "Forget it," they said. One guy, a rower from Penn who had just competed at the Henley Regatta, said that he was meeting buddies in Pamplona to run with the bulls and that I should join them. The girl next to me was Welsh and headed to the south of France to wait on tables and lie on the beach, kind of a working vacation. "Come with," she offered. "No, no," I said. "If I don't get back, I'm going to lose her." I was roundly ridiculed, and they said I would forever regret cutting short this once-in-a-lifetime trip. In Paris, my spirits buoyed. I headed straight for Charles de Gaulle Airport. I'd be home in New York by that night and in Chicago the day after that. All I had to do was get on a plane. But I couldn't get on a plane. Inside the United Terminal, it looked like the fall of Saigon. Utter chaos, with people 40 deep at the ticket counter. I would not be getting on the next plane, or the plane after that, or any other plane. I would be lucky, the ticket agent said, to get a flight 3 weeks from now. Exhausted and despondent, I lugged my backpack toward the trains, tears welling in my eyes. What a disaster. Stuck in Paris for 3 weeks. Could things be any worse? But as I left the bedlam of the United Terminal, I found myself in the British Airways wing. It was empty and tranquil, and I was facing 3 smiling ticket agents. Was this a mirage? You don't happen to have any seats in New York today. I would have settled for not being laughed at.
We have seats, one said, but the plane leaves in 20 minutes.
The one-way ticket cost twice what my parents had paid for my original round-trip fare. I glanced at my credit card, for emergency use only. I bought the tickets. This was the part of the story I didn't tell my parents. At least not until 4 years later, on the night before Joelle and I were married. I confessed it as a punchline at our rehearsal dinner. After my father told a room full of friends and family the tale of the despondent boy who chose love over bleeding sheep, Roman ruins, and all the wine in Paris.
Griffin Dunn, reading David Vesey's essay, Before the Web, Hearts Grew Silent. We'll hear from David after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing?
It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question,
you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building.
Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. David Vesey's essay was published in 2013, but he wrote his first draft about 20 years before that. He even submitted it to the New York Times About Men column, which no longer exists today.
And they rejected it soundly. And I think I put it in the closet after that, as writers are wont to do when something gets turned away. And then after reading a few Modern Love essays, I retooled it with now a look back of 20 years.
Looking back got David thinking about how much technology has changed relationships and even the way we think about the world.
My common question is, you know, remember what it used to be like to wonder about things. We never have that period where we mull something for a long time. It's sort of like the answer's always at our fingertips. And so our reflective qualities, I think, have diminished. And to me, that's sad because I enjoy that stuff. I mean, I enjoy sort of just staring off at the ocean and wondering about one thing for 45 minutes and wondering if I'll ever know the answer to it, which, of course, I could do if I just, you know, took my phone out of my back pocket.
Revisiting this time in his life also made David realize how crucial a role his parents played in his love story with Joelle.
How many parents really would say, forget the next month you were supposed to spend in Europe and go home and just make yourself happy? And that was kind of their parental instinct. I don't think I even considered that as an option. I mean, I had a plane ticket and it was like, that's my plane ticket and who am I to change it? And for them to unsolicited say, just go home, it was really special in a way.
So special that David thinks it may be what saved his relationship with Joelle.
I actually do believe that we would not be together if I had stayed for the rest of my trip. And part of it was, and it's not a reflection on our feelings towards each other, I mean, I think we were deeply in love at the time. I just think that you know, had another month gone by, if I just tramped around Europe, maybe those feelings would have become more distant over that time. She would have settled into Chicago, and I would have come home and just settled into whatever I was going to do. She says that she was waiting for me to come back, and I think that's a very nice thing for her to say, and I choose to believe it.
David and Joelle live in Port Washington, New York, with their 15 and 18-year-old daughters. They've been married for nearly 22 years now, and their love story is no longer sitting in David's closet.
You know, we look back at this story, it's sort of like a good party story for us all the time, and now this essay is hanging in the hallway, you know, sort of a focal point of our little journey together.
David Vesey. He's an assistant news editor at the New York Times. Griffin Dunn told us that he knew within the first paragraph that he wanted to read David Vesey's essay. We'll find out why in a minute.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
For Griffin Dunn, David Vesey's essay was a nostalgic look back at dating before the internet.
You know, when you said you would be somewhere, you would be somewhere because there was no way to cancel in a text at the last second. Post-relationships, I find myself becoming incredibly annoyed if somebody I'm texting doesn't get back to me within 30 seconds. You know, where before you'd find out if the person was thinking of you by, if you had one, listening to your answering machine at the end of the night. We just fight for different reasons now with our lovers.
And Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, echoed that sentiment.
This is the kind of story that reminds us of how dramatically things have changed, just in terms of how we can keep tabs on people and stay in touch with people or not. He would not these days ever wind up in that situation where he wouldn't be able to see her Facebook posts or her Instagram pictures of Chicago and be able to trace her every move. And not knowing any of that, it just raised the stakes through the roof. And I just wonder, how much is romance dependent on doubt and allowing your emotions to sort of snowball into this sense of, oh my God, I've got to get on a train, get on a plane, fly across the ocean and find this person. You know, it just doesn't exist anymore in the way that it used to.
Thanks again to Griffin Dunn for reading David's essay. Griffin stars in the Amazon series I Love Dick, opposite Katherine Hahn, who's also read for the podcast. You can find her episode and our full archive at wbur.org/modernlove. Next week, Danielle Brooks, who plays Tasty on the Netflix series Orange is the New Black, reads a story about an overprotective father and the art of Google stalking.
Here's what I knew. He had a binder. My mother denied it. My sister had seen it. Yet my father wouldn't confess because he knew his actions were overstepping my boundaries. So you're not going to let me see it? I asked. I don't know what you're talking about. If my father hadn't become an engineer, he would have made a great spy.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.